Thanks, Jim, and hi. Good morning, everybody. My name is Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am really grateful to be here this morning. I have noticed all weekend that you all are a really pretty bunch of drunks. I want to thank everybody involved. I know Lee had a lot to do with setting it up, and Ann running everything, keeping it in order, and all the committee, and Jim and his sidekick Chris did a great job of picking me up and getting me from the airport to here, and everybody has just treated me wonderfully. So many people here I know and love, other speakers and a lot of my friends from Virginia and other places that it's just wonderful to have been able to become a part of an AA fellowship that's bigger than Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I'm from. And I'm just grateful, so grateful. But I got to tell you, anytime I get asked to speak at something like this, and by the way, has everybody enjoyed this laid-back, lazy weekend? But anytime I get asked to share at something like this, my goodness, I start looking, and the speakers are just a pantheon of household name public servants, you know, paragons of humility, every one of us. And and seriously, you know, I have a tad of egomania. And also, believe it or not, I've got an equal amount of inferiority complex. And these two things just carry on all the time. So this kind of conversation, my God, you know, do you really belong with these people? Of course you don't really belong with these people. If they really knew who you are and all the ways you mess up and what a fraud you are, of course you don't. Well, certainly I belong. My God, I've been doing this for so many years, you know. And so on and so forth. So I decided, you know, you can decide that it's self-esteem rather than ego, because self-esteem's a good thing, right? psychologists tell us it is. So I had pretty well decided, yes, I do belong in this pantheon. And I'd gotten rather comfortable with that and was practicing wearing it humbly and gracefully. And that continued right up until I picked up my name tag and they had misspelled my name. God has a delightful way of making God's points with me. And I hope over the next few minutes we can get some divine intervention. If you are like I was when I first came around, and are terribly intellectually offended by some religious fanatic spouting off about something like divine intervention, just use magic from the steps, because it winds up being just precisely the same thing. And I hope we get some this morning. I need it. I always need it. I need it first to get me out of the way. I used to stand up to go, oh, by the way, my sobriety date's April 9th, 1981. And my home group is the Calm Down Group. And that's across the river from downtown Louisville, Kentucky, in southern Indiana. And you're welcome there. It's a 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. Wednesday meeting. You're welcome anytime you're coming through. And by the way, I named the Calm Down Group 20 years ago because I needed it so badly. But I used to stand up to give a talk, and I'd say, if I can get me out of the way, I'll do this or I'll do that. If I could get me out of the way, I could have stayed in Louisville and watched basketball this weekend. I wouldn't need any of this if I could get me out of the way. I'm not a bit more capable of getting me out of the way, not a bit, than I was in April of 1981. It truly takes divine intervention or the magic of the steps to get me out of the way. And another place we're really going to need divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions. And I have got a really long and sad history with the directions. And that all starts, of course, with my case being different. And then it goes on that the directions have never applied to me. And even if they did, they never mean what they say. You know, directions are being made by square johns to manipulate idiots into doing things. And in my special circumstances, you have to sort of extrapolate, you know, in order to figure out what the directions might really mean. And that happens automatically with me. It doesn't require any effort. And without divine intervention, if I look at some directions that say, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain will actually register that as something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So I hope we get a little divine intervention. And you know, I found out that I don't get much divine intervention on Sunday based on what I did on Saturday. It truly is a day at a time thing. It's based on truly just what I do today. So I hope I've done enough today to open myself up to the divine intervention. And I'm supposed to talk to you guys about steps 10 and 11. I'm really excited about that. I love to talk about the maintenance steps. So I want to take just a couple of minutes and give you a background of how I got to the maintenance steps, because I was sponsored and I believe that the first 9 steps are the program of recovery in its entirety. I believe that once we've done the first 9 steps, if we've done them the way the book says do them, that we will be in a state of recovery from alcoholism. Now, my original sponsor, who was Cherry Carpenter from Nashville, Tennessee, made it very clear that in my case, I could expect that condition to last about 8 seconds, because the steps are a process of ego deflation. And 8 seconds is about the outside limit on how long my ego can ever stay deflated. I have to go right back to the trough. And you know, everybody that's talked this weekend, and the folks that are here are people that I've known and been with by and large a lot of times over the years, we have the same message. It's all the same message. Thank God we've got all these different ways of delivering that message, but the message is the same. The message is really simple. And we have different paths that we get to it. Now my friend Bob B. over there, Bob's one of my heroes. In fact, we cannot have contact for a year or two, and he still seems to come across things about 2 years before I do. It kind of aggravates me. But we come across the same thing. My friend Bob is really a seeker, and like my friend Billy H. in Louisville, and seeking through all these different channels and so on. My friend Billy has got a Buddhist garden in his backyard with statues, and he's got the robe and all this crap. And one time he got concerned about being too materialistic, and the first month after that he spent $1,800 on books on how not to be materialistic. And that's not an exaggeration. That's really true. Now, my experience is different. And that works. That's my whole point, that works. I was told by Cherry Carpenter that he was going to get into all the other stuff as soon as he mastered the big book. Well, Cherry never mastered the big book. And I've kind of gone the same way. And here's what I find. When I get in my gray periods, and God, I get in my gray periods, how you would separate my gray periods from clinical depression, I don't have a clue. You know, it may have something to do with what I choose to name it, but I have some periods when my limbs feel like they weigh 50 pounds, when cleaning up and taking a shower in the morning seems like a fellow ought to get $500,000 a year just for going through that, for God's sake. You know, it's just awful. And I have those periods, and I want to seek too, and I do seek. After all, I've been speaking on the circuit for a long, long time and sponsor a bunch of folks and, a lot of things I look around at and, gee, you know, I'm pretty advanced here in AA. And what I really need to do is call Bob or Dick or their Bob D or Ralph or Mary or some of the other luminaries in AA and find some elevated spiritual knowledge that I can apply that will lift me out of my gray period. Unfortunately, what I usually have to do, what I'm doing while I'm doing that, is overlooking what I learned to do the first 30 days I was sober. And my solution is almost always the same solution that it was when I was 30 days sober. I need to go to more meetings. I need to talk to somebody about what's going on. I need to pray. I need to get a pencil and a piece of paper out and start writing about it. Cherry used to say that a pencil and a piece of paper are a recovering person's best friends. Same thing. See, that's my trouble. If something works well enough, I'll quit. I have done that over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous. If it works well enough, I will quit. And sometimes getting back to it is just unbelievably difficult. An example, it's a spiritual thing. Got sober in 81. Sometime the first month or two after I got sober, I decided I needed to exercise. And I started doing sit-ups, push-ups, and leg lifts every morning. And I worked up to 30 each of them. I did not miss a day for 5 years. Not one day. In 1986, I missed a day. And I haven't done it since. And I really felt great. You know, I really felt great. I got all sorts of wonderful benefits from it. But it just works so well that I quit. I have got kind of a story, I guess it borders on a horror story. I grew up on a tobacco farm in down in southwestern Kentucky. I was always really blessed academically. I started drinking alcoholically when I was 12 or 13. I've been driven all my life by an ego disorder. The book says that selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of our troubles, and to me that means that I've got an ego disorder. That ego has devoured everything else in my life. It goes back to devouring everything else in my life on any day that I let up on what I need to do on this step work and in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That ego gets bigger and sleeker and fatter and greasier, and it just eats up everything else in my life. It robbed me of the ability to even consider a power greater than myself that had anything to do with running my life. It robbed me of the ability to even consider that anything could be more important in running my life than my brain. My brain had to be the most important thing in running my life. It made me an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. It robbed me of any real teachability or humility, any ability to do anything that was suggested unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And with what I've got, this illness that talks to me, telling me all these things, trying to get a drink that might kill me, and with my disorder of perception, which means that I can't always recognize those lies even today, that's a recipe for death. That's a recipe for death because, you see, my brain talking to me and my alcoholism talking to me, if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get my divine intervention, are one and the same thing because I've got an alcoholic brain. And I don't believe my alcoholism has ever tried to kill me, and that is terrifying. That is absolutely terrifying because I nearly died from alcoholism dozens of times. But the reason it's never tried to kill me is my alcoholism doesn't care whether I live or die. And my alcoholism doesn't care whether you live or die. It's the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing, and that's try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything in the world in order to get it. And that disorder of my perception will cause me to believe that if I've got that final veto in the universe in my brain, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it'll work. It's a death sentence for me. Started drinking alcoholically, never looked back from that. Alcohol dominated my life for 25 years. I was an early admission student at 16 in college with a full academic scholarship. Blew that the first semester for staying so drunk. I lost all concept of day and night. Went to work full time, went to school full time, drank full time for 7.5 years. Somehow got through undergraduate and law school. Don't even remember a handful of things about that. It's just a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. Started practicing law in Louisville, Kentucky in the spring of 1968. And my daughter Dana, who was born, she's just a dear friend of mine. Some of you guys know some things that Dana and I have done together, was born in that spring. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville. And I practiced for about 10 years with a good deal of success. Then in February of 78, blown out of my mind on with an alcohol of more than 0.40 and a cornucopia of other substances along with it in my system. I drove a car off the road 130 miles an hour, tore my body all to pieces. Broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost main artery in one lower leg, had to do a bypass in the upper leg and take out a vein graft, then to replace the artery. Separated my pelvis, pulled my plumbing in two, didn't have a urinary function for over a year, had a suprapubic catheter, plastic tube with a flange in it, which carries your urine out to a bag. Thought I would never be able to walk without braces. That's what the doctor said. Thought I'd never have a urinary function. Turned out it was not that way, thank God. It still took me 3.5 years after that to stop drinking. My attitude after that wreck was that if you couldn't take the heat, get out of the kitchen, and that anybody could quit drinking when the going got a little tough. But it took a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in, and that's absolute insanity. That's absolute insanity. It's absolute powerlessness, and it absolutely highlights what I believe is the bedrock of my alcoholism. The bedrock, what the whole thing is built on, is this part of my ego disorder. Without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world. Every time. That's if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get the divine intervention, it is just as true this morning as it was in April of 1981. I can give a little lip service without divine intervention to something being more important than how I feel, and I might be able to act for just a few minutes like something's more important, but if I haven't done the work and gotten the divine intervention or the magic from the steps, that's all a smokescreen. When the chips get down, I'm going to go back to my default position, and my default position is always to let how I feel be the most important thing in this universe. By the greatest miracle that's ever happened in my life or ever will, April of 81, I got a little bit of teachability or humility, got sober. Miracles happened, and my life for the last almost 30 years has been just a roller coaster ride of miracles. I was at a podium somewhere a few months ago and made the statement that I've been in the fourth dimension of existence 5,000 times. And then all of a sudden I just stopped and said, you know, that means I've fallen out of it 4,999. And that's the way it is with me. When I first began to become open to spiritual things, I had this idea that spiritual growth would be a steady, continuing upward plane. Now, for me it's been stumbling and falling sometimes 50 to 100 times a day. Forgetting that I ever did a third step, forgetting that I ever did a seventh step, forgetting that there's any such thing as an 11th step to live on, getting knocked in the dust by my ego, and remembering one more time, oh yeah, and Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, excuse me, I fouled it up again, and stumble another couple of steps in the right direction to get knocked on my butt by the ego again. And the wonderful thing is my God doesn't require perfection from me. It turns out that he or she doesn't even really require what you would call consistency. My God is tickled to death with persistence. Just persistence. Just keeping on stumbling in that right direction. I think it might have been Thomas Merton who said, I don't know what pleases you, God, but I believe that the desire to please you does. And as long as I'm stumbling in the right direction, my God takes care of it. Well, after Jerry Carpenter told me that my relief from my ego would last about 8 seconds after finishing the ninth step, he started talking to me about the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps, the maintenance steps. And those are designed for living. And I'm going to spend the rest of my little time here, hopefully, talking about that. You know, I have trouble reading the big book. And here's the reason that I have trouble reading the big book. I already know what it says. And a part of my morning meditation for years has been to read the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and page 86, 87, 88 on the 11th step. 99 times out of 100, My eyes will glance at those pages. My brain will register, yeah, we know what that says, and we'll go right on. Maybe one time out of 100 or less, I'll be given the great gift of being able to see what the ink on the paper says instead of what I think it says. And sometimes it makes a tremendous difference. And leading into the maintenance steps is probably the most vivid example of that in my sobriety. I had read through that dozens of times. I'd heard it talked about, and it was very clear to me that my daily reprieve from alcoholism, that I wasn't cured from it, that what I had was a daily reprieve, and that it was contingent on my spiritual condition. Well, that got awfully scary, because if it is contingent on my spiritual condition, that means it is contingent on how I am. And sometimes I ain't very good. You know, sometimes I still wake up after all these years sober with my brain spinning. I still wake up and I feel separated from you. I feel separated from God. I don't want to do any of this unselfish stuff. I want to work on me. I want to obsess on myself. I'm cut off. At least as best I can tell, my spiritual condition is El Crapo. So if the way I had understood the book was correct, I'm in mortal danger of being struck drunk that day because I am terrible. But thank God that's not what the ink on the paper says. The ink on the paper says that my daily reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Completely different animal. The difference of switching that light switch out there, of flipping that light switch on and off. You see, my spiritual condition is something that I am immediately powerless over. I don't have a wand to wave to change the condition of my spirit or change the condition of my automobile or change the condition of my wardrobe or my work. I can't change any of that with a wave of the wand. On the other hand, the maintenance of my spiritual condition is a program of action over which I have 100% control. And what that means is that I can wake up on that morning when I'm feeling all those obsessions with myself and that fear, get down to pray, can't remember the last word, I just tried to pray, it feels obvious to me that the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling, couldn't possibly help. I look at the meditation books, can't remember a word, to sit there with my piece of paper to make a gratitude list and have to wait 5 minutes before I can think of my eyes, and then start listing things I would be grateful for if I had any sanity, and then I can go down to my office where all the big deals are going on, and God, I love big deals. My alcoholism is a disease of big deals. The truth is, anytime I make a big deal out of anything that is not God in these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. You see, you come to me with your problems about your health, your child, your money, your sex life. I can be St. Francis. I really can. I can just really point you in the right direction, and I can tell you, just get in your helicopter and lift up above this traffic jam you're in. Can't you see that God's got you in the palm of his or her hand? And it's all going to be, oh, my goodness, stop trying to figure out the pattern. That belongs to God. Our job is stitching. Just listen to that little spark of the divine inside you and take that stitch in the next place, and God will lead you to places you couldn't even imagine. And then you leave, and I say, I wonder why the poor fellow was so distraught. You let the same thing happen to me 10 minutes later, and oh, my God, it's the end of the world. Because it's my health, it's my child, it's my money, it's my this or my that. And then any time I make a big deal out of anything that's not God in these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego and I'm back into alcoholism. But anyway, on this day I'm talking about where I'm spiritually El Crapo, I get down to the office and I assure you I'll be besieged by my big deals. And maybe in the middle of the morning, sponsor, I don't think I'm sponsoring a Joe, so we'll call him Joe right now. So Joe, the sponsor, calls, and Joe has called 10 times in the last 2 days to talk about the girl. Now, I have told Joe when I started sponsoring him the way I tell everybody that for me to give advice on finances or romance is really ought to be a felony, and that I can't do that. But nevertheless, Joe's called 8 or 10 times about the girl. Every fiber of my being will say, oh, for God's sake, Katie, take a message. I'll get back to him later. But what I can do, I can take a deep breath. I can pray those magic 11th step prayers. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Joe rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. Let me not ask the question, what can I get out of this? But rather the right question, what can I bring to this? And I can say to Katie, put him through. And I can pick up that phone and say, good morning, Joe. How are you, buddy? What can I do for you? And I can keep on running those prayers through my brain because those are not something that I say once and then I've got it. Those are therapy for me that I keep saying it, I keep saying it, I keep saying it. And then a series of miracles will start to happen. The first miracle will be that it will make me what I am not. It will make me a listener. Without divine intervention, when I appear to be listening to you, my brain could regurgitate the exact words you just said if my old ears can still hear it. They could regurgitate it to you just like that, but the truth is I'm thinking about 4 or 5 different things. A couple of them to do with what I'm going to say next, how that's going to look, 2 or 3 of them unrelated on just other things. My brain is just going everywhere, but when I pray those 11th step prayers, that magic happens, and I begin to really listen. I begin to really hear what you're saying to me. And I believe that's one of the greatest gifts that we can give another human being. And then another piece of magic happens, and Chuck Chamberlain talked about this. When I pray that until I really, really do begin to give my entire interest, attention, and love for that moment to Joe and that stupid girl, Joe and the girl for that moment become the most interesting thing in the world to me. All sorts of miracles. Well, I'll get down with Joe, and I guarantee you I'll go right back to my big deals, and I'll go right back to the chaos I'm creating, swimming around. Ram, it comes noontime. There's a meeting over at the club where my home group is at noon, meets 5 days a week at noon. I've been to that meeting hundreds and hundreds of times. Can't hear in that room. I'm about 2/3 deaf anyway. The acoustics are terrible. I don't hear 1 word out of 5 that's said. It's a discussion meeting. That doesn't matter because I know everybody who goes there and what they're going to say anyway. And it's absolutely clear that I am too busy. In fact, it would be irresponsible. It would be irresponsible with the big deals I've got going on to go out and get in the car and go over there to that stupid meeting. But I can make myself go out and get in the car and drive across that river and walk in there and be praying, Lord, please let me set aside whether I get any love, comfort, and understanding, and please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand the folks here. And let me not ask, what am I going to get out of this, but let me ask what I can bring to it. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And I can go in there, and I can sit through that meeting, and I might be able to give a little something. And my point is, I can get through that day with an absolute guarantee that I won't drink because I'm doing the action that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that's what will get my daily reprieve. Now, the flip side of that, I wake up feeling so centered and spiritual that God and I are going to join hands and go out and drift through the ether and merge with the Tao, you know. And it comes time to pray, and I can decide, oh, that would be redundant. My whole life is a prayer. And I can look at my little meditation books I've been reading for 30 years, think I'm so far beyond that. And when I'm down at the office, instead of on a day like that when I'm so centered, I probably won't be beset with business big deals unless something happens, like an acorn falling on my head. But if no acorn is falling on my head, so the sky's not falling for me that morning, I may be sitting there contemplating my belly button and getting ready to move to a higher spiritual plane. And it may be that when Joe calls about the girl that I feel the greatest of love and compassion for Joe. Just so spiritually centered, but I'm involved in spiritual graduate school and don't have time to talk to him right at this moment. And I can make the same decisions about the meeting at noon and get drunker and cooter bound that day, even though I think I'm so centered and I think I am so spiritual, because my daily reprieve is not based on how I am. My daily reprieve is based on what I do. The 10th step's a wonderful step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Continue to take personal inventory involves a number of things for me. It involves, of course, as I go through the day, when I'm wrong, trying to admit it promptly. Cherry Carpenter said the word promptly is only there for my comfort. If I want to be comfortable eventually, I can eventually admit I'm wrong. But if I want to be comfortable promptly, I better promptly admit that I'm wrong. I use from the 11th step, the paragraph on page 86, when we retire at night, which is a wonderful checklist about the end of the day. Where was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do I owe an apology? Have I kept something to myself that should be discussed with another person at once? Was I kind and loving toward all? What could I have done better? And then the questions really get hard. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Or was I thinking of what I could do for others, or what I could pack into the stream of life? But then it says I have to be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, not because that will make me uncomfortable, and not because that would hinder my spiritual growth, but because that would diminish my usefulness to others. And folks, it's in all the steps. The third step prayer, take away my difficulties, not so I can be spiritual, happy, and sober, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of God's love and power and way of life. Steps 8 and 9, putting our lives in order, absolutely. But the book says that's not our real purpose. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. Guys, I have got an illness that is self-centeredness. I can't effectively treat it by more obsession on self. And God, I love to obsess on self. Nothing else makes me so exquisitely miserable. And I'm an absolute master at disguising obsession on self. I'll dress it up in psychological clothing. I'll dress it up in spiritual clothing and declare it not obsession on self. Trying to treat what's wrong with me by obsessing on myself is like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. It simply cannot be done. I've got to lay aside what's going to happen to me. I've got to lay aside all this taking care of me. And I've got to ask what I can do for you. I've got to try to help God's kids, as Chuck said, do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. When I truly see it as my job to help you and God's job to take care of me, the miracles in my life have just been, they're unbelievable. What God will do in my life when I quit trying to fix it, when I realize, and I stole this from Bob B. probably 20 years ago, on the days when I'm an ant floating down the river on a log, running back and forth on that log, thinking he's steering the log. And I have spent most of my days that way. I have squandered most of the days of my life. Being an ant thinking he was steering the log. But on the days when I really realize that I'm ant and I can't steer that log, and the only glimpse of God's will I will ever get is in the right now. I don't know God's will for 5 seconds from now, but in the next 5 seconds one of us could have a heart attack or a seizure, electricity could go off, sprinkler system come on, police come in here looking for one of us that hadn't finished our amends. Also, all sorts of things could happen in the next 5 seconds to completely destroy what I believe God's will be 5 seconds from now. And yet I want to worry about God's will for tomorrow and 5 years from now. A chimpanzee has got a better chance of mastering quantum physics than I do of understanding the patterns of my life. My job is stitching. Listen to that little spark of the divine, like I was talking about Telly Joe, and take that next stitch. And when I do that, God takes me to places that I absolutely can't imagine. Continuing to take personal inventory for me has also included written inventories at intervals during my sobriety. I've never had a certain interval that I do one at this point or that point. I've probably done 12 or 15 in the period of time that I've been sober. When it seems like I need to do them the most is when there have been big upheavals and changes in my life. When I've been through some sort of trauma, big changes is when I need to do that. I need to go back, and I don't need to re-inventory Mama and the Yardstick and the cookies when I was three. I'm over that, you know. But inventory the things that are alive in my life. And I always use the big book just precisely. The other things may be wonderful, and I have sponsees who use the other things. I'm not on a soapbox. I don't know what's good for anybody else, but I know this book just like it is works for me. And I know that for every problem I have ever had in my life, by oversimplifying, I have had 10,000 by overcomplicating. And that's truly 10,000 to one. In the first couple of months I was sober, there's an old boy by the name of Weldon who was a college professor in Nashville. Did not stay sober. In fact, poor Weldon died drunk. But we were at Shoney's after a meeting. I remember he made a statement that really has helped me for the last 30 years. He said, you know, I remember Weldon was 46. He said, you know, I'm 46 years old and I have thought all my life that the proper function of the human intellect was to complicate. And I'm beginning to understand that the proper function of the human intellect is to simplify. And it's usually that with me, to just make it that simple. That's my trouble with 6 and 7. My brain and my ego will just repeatedly not accept that 6 and 7 are as simple as they are. And also, it's a death of self. You know, this idea that, by God, we're going to envision it, grab it by the ears, and make it happen is so ingrained in us that letting go of the idea that we can do that truly is a death of ourselves. It's really difficult. And there's a lot of great stuff. You know, the book doesn't talk about the 10th step except for a couple of pages, but boy, Bill crammed a lot in there. It says that this is the point at which we have entered the world of the Spirit. It says that this is where our AA code is. It says that when we have problems, when things crop up, we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. You're going to see that in every step. The chapter that Dick's going to talk about, working with others, begins with one of my favorite lines in the book, saying that practical experience has shown that nothing will so much ensure our immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics. Folks, that means that prayer won't ensure it that much, meetings won't ensure it that much, step work won't ensure it that much other than that. Now, not that all those things aren't absolutely necessary. What it means is that I don't think I have my phone with me, do I? That's embarrassing. That's really embarrassing. It was a sponsee from Louisville. I should have stopped and talked to him a minute. Let you say hello to Brian. Well, between that and the misspelled name on the name tag, I'm in good shape this morning, guys. God does have a way. Didn't I tell you that we didn't know in the next 5 seconds what God's will would be? And I really did not have Brian Cole on purpose. But actually, I think I can claim that. That would be great. But anyway, back to the 10th step. It's where our AA code is. It says that love and tolerance of others is our code. That is the code of Alcoholics Anonymous. Responsibility and efficiency are wonderful things, and there's an extremely spiritual aspect to those things. I turned my life into a living hell by not returning my telephone calls for 48 hours. I truly can. I'd plunge it into absolute chaos. No question, there's a huge spiritual aspect to efficiency and responsibility, but that's not the AA code. The AA code is love and tolerance of others. I've had to learn some hard lessons with tolerance. I didn't know what tolerance was. I thought a high threshold for aggravation was tolerance. If what you did mildly irritated me, but I was able to shrug it off, I thought I was being tolerant. Turns out tolerance is not even an issue until I find the situation intolerable. It's not an issue until every fiber of my being screams, "My God, they're going to destroy Alcoholics Anonymous, and somebody's got to do something about them, and I think God just anointed me. I want AA to be here for my grandkids, and by God, I've got to do something about this now." That's when tolerance becomes an issue. I do use tough love. I really do. But if there is any doubt in my mind whether to use tough love or whether to be kind, I choose to err on the side of kindness every single time. And I've, over the years, I've thought about that. I would rather have on my tombstone, "Don was kind," than to have on my tombstone, "Don didn't take any crap." So it works very well for me, if I'm going to err on the side of kindness. Bob D. was talking about that in his talk, dealing with the poor fellow with the abusive father. It's just my way, and it's worked me well. We've got the 10-step promises, which I'm not going to read to you. In fact, somebody else, Bob B., may have talked about them last night. But the 10-step promises are beautiful. That's where it says we're going to be in a position of neutrality with regard to liquor, that we're going to stop fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol. I have had that promise, and it has stuck with me more consistently than most of the promises in these books. If anybody has caught me arguing with anybody in the last 25 years, somebody was paying me. I will not argue with you for nothing to make my belly hurt. It's simply I've been relieved, thank God, a day at a time with the obsession to be right. I've been given the great gift of knowing that I don't have any idea what's right for you. In fact, most days I ain't got a clue what's right for me. What I need to do is just the best I can and be loving and tolerant of you, but to hold out my hand and help you. I need to tell you the truth. Sometimes the truth is hurtful, but I was told by Cherry Carpenter that honesty without compassion is not really honesty. It's a disguised form of hostility. That I have to always temper my honesty with compassion. And that works very, 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 very well for me. It says every day, and then we have the 10th step prayer. It says every day we carry the vision of God's will into our activities, and then in quotation marks on page 85, "How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done." Interesting that you got the same prayer and the same deal in 10 and 11, because then it says these are thoughts which must go with us constantly. When we get to 11, we're going to see that the 11th step prayer is that all through the day we constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." Bill's doing what he does so many times in this book. Usually he does it one right after another. But something that Bill thought was extremely important, he will repeat over and over in a different context or in different words so that he gets the point across. And that has to do... I want to really spend most of my few minutes that I've got left here talking about what I call the other 98% of the 11th step. The 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. My prayer is not refined down to that. I understand that Chuck Chamberlain's was before his death, that his prayer truly was, "God, give me knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out." I try to let that be the essence of my prayer. I try not to pray for my own selfish ends. I like to have died, spent 9 years of having loads of trouble in sobriety, thinking that I could pray away the character defects that were making me uncomfortable, that I could work them away. And the 7th step prayer makes it clear you can't pray for God to take away all your character defects. if you do that, you might as well be praying for a bright red Ferrari. The 11th step tells us that praying for our own selfish ends will not work. Says you can easily see why. It took me 9 years to easily see why. We're praying only for the removal of those character defects that stand in the way of the usefulness to God and our fellows, and I don't know which ones they are. I don't have a clue who and what a perfect spiritual Don would be. If God gave me the power to become anything or anybody that I thought I ought to be right now, I'd be like a blind dog in a butcher shop. I'd have no idea who and what I ought to be. I'm back to that little stitcher. To not trying to figure out the patterns, trying to stitch. The second step, like kill me, they finally got it through my head that I didn't have to think, feel, or believe anything. And if I had waited until my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs changed before I started getting on my knees every morning and every night in April of 81, I would have been in a pauper's grave for over 30 years now. that great gift was that I started getting on my knees. As far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees. I have probably batted 80% of the times for the last 30 years. I've done pretty good morning meditation of my reading, gratitude list, and so on. So I've done real well on that. Probably only batted about 500 on doing the checklist at the end of the day that I read, you know, when we retire at night about the day. But I batted 500 on that. In baseball, that'll get you in the Hall of Fame, you know. And I've never failed getting on my knees at night as well as in the morning. It's the other 98% of the 11th step that I have trouble with. Because the morning and night, and it's real easy, I'll get to assuming if I've done my morning deal, my evening deal, oh yeah, I'm doing the 11th step well, Bob, I've got it together. The book could not be more clear, and it's so few words, and so powerful. It starts on the bottom of page 9. Oh, by the way, as far as starting in the morning, it says on awakening, we think about our 24 hours, ask God to direct our thinking, asking especially to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I asked Cherry Carpenter early on how and when I should begin during the day to establish my conscious contact with God, and he directed me to page 86 and that on awakening deal, and I'll tell you what he said. He said, if that had meant after you went to the bathroom, it would have said after we peed, we asked God to direct our thinking. He said, and you need to condition yourself to do that as soon as your eyes fly open. He said, the first reason is that you need to follow directions as badly as anybody I have ever seen in my life. He said, the second reason is that you are perfectly capable of getting crazy enough between the bed and the bathroom to ruin the rest of your life. So over the years, I pretty well... pretty well got myself conditioned. Pretty soon after those eyes fly open, it goes through that will be, or rather, please direct my thinking, especially if it be divorced, self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. But both the 10th and 11th step talk about attitude, and before going with 11, I want to talk about the word attitude for a minute, because words are so important to me in sobriety. I have found out that whatever I name something or somebody is going to have almost everything to do with what the reality of that something or somebody to me is. Now, the first few months that I was sober, man, I was having problems with the attitude thing because everybody was telling me, you got to change your attitude. You've got to change your attitude. If you don't get an attitude of gratitude, you're going to get drunk. Well, the only thing I ever thought an attitude was is what I think, feel, or believe. Of course, I think that is the center of the universe without divine intervention. You know, what I do must be an outcropping of what I think, feel, and believe. And if we're going to change me, we have to somehow work on me and change what I think, feel, and believe so I feel like doing the right thing. Little problem with that. Last 30 years, I prayed my butt off about God fixing me to make me feel like doing right. I've done probably a foot and a half or 2 feet of inventories on it. I've worried sponsors to death. After I got back to practice law and got a little money, I spent a good deal of money on outside counseling trying to get me fixed up so I would feel like doing right, so I could do right. And if you're an alcoholic of my ilk, I'm about to give you some really bad news. 30 years, not one single time has anything made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And that is more maturity than I can nearly stand, I guarantee you. But at any rate, the attitude. Cherry sent me to a dictionary, which always irritated me because I knew I was better read than Cherry and smarter and all that good stuff. And the dictionary that he sent me to look up attitude, the first definition had nothing to do with what I think or what I feel or what I believe. It was a term from geometry and aviation, angle of approach. And that was one of those moments like turning a light on and off, because instantly my attitude went from something totally beyond my control to something totally within my control. Because my angle of approach to you or anything in my life doesn't have anything to do with the old crazy picture show in the back of my head. It's how I act toward you or anything else in my life. Great, great thing for me to learn that my attitude is mine to control because it's my angle of approach. But at any rate, bottom of page 87 talks about the other 98% of the day. It says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. And by the way, I had that explained to me that the word constantly is used both here and in the 10th step in that regard because I am constantly trying to run the show. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, again in quotation marks, just like in the 10th step, thy will be done. That's it. That's the other 98%. As I go through the day to run through my head all day, thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Now I've added to it from the 12 and 12 in the prayer of St. Francis, which is, I think, page 99 on the 12 and 12 where it talks about the 11th step. I have added to it to pray to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. One great paradox on that, on the praying to love, comfort, and understand, it has been my absolute experience that if any part of me is trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me, any part of me, and unfortunately trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me includes some things that I wish it didn't include. It includes making sure you respect me. It includes making sure you let me have my rights. It includes things I wish it didn't include. But if any part of me is trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me, I have found it to be an absolute spiritual law for me that I will not be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. Cannot happen. If you do exactly what I thought I wanted you to do, before you're done, I'll change what I wanted you to do. It just cannot happen. The paradox is this. The only time it's possible for me to feel loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I'm really praying that prayer of, Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood until that gets some reality for me. And when that gets reality, I wind up loved, comforted, and understood beyond my wildest dreams. Just beyond my wildest dreams. Of course, what happens is when that happens, I like it, and I try to grab hold of it, and poof, it's gone. And I got to start all over again with it. That's the same paradox as the question, what am I getting out of this? For me, it's just the wrong question. Because you let me ask that question about anything, AA, my marriage, my work, any part of my life, and then really contemplate it about 30 seconds. And the answer is going to be not enough. So it's just the wrong question. The only time it's possible for me to feel like I'm getting what I need to get out of anything is when I've laid aside that question, and I'm coming to it with the question, what can I bring to this? But going on with our little 11th step there, it's just stated the whole 98%. As I go through the day, I constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show, humbly saying to myself many times each day that I will be done, and in the same paragraph, it gives us the very beautiful 11th step promises, top of page 88. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. My God, what promises. And how badly I need those really practical promises. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And then it's followed by the shortest paragraph in the big book. It works. It really does. And he's making it real clear, this is not some sort of spiritual woo-woo here. This is not something that tweaks our spiritual condition. This is absolutely practical. It'll make you a better lawyer. It'll make you a better plumber. It'll make you a better truck driver. It'll make you a better father, mother, sister, brother, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll make you a better anything on the face of this earth. If we'll just run through our head every day, all day, thou will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Thou will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Over the years, I've done some really silly sounding things. I have put a rubber band around my wrist and known that that was to remind me to do my 11th step all day. I've wadded up pieces of paper and put them in the pocket of my coat so I'd reach down and feel it, and that would remind me, thou will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Liz Pill, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand. I've done all sorts of things to remind me. I have opened the car door to let God get in with me. I have held the door to the room open. And thank God for Bluetooth technology, because not nearly as many people think I'm nuts sitting in the car by myself talking. Ten and 11 are really, really important. They've done so much for me, and I just so much appreciate being a part of this weekend. And you all are lovely, and it's a great spirit here. And the other speakers have just been fantastic. And I've got some of my real heroes here. My 6 and 7 thing that changed my life 21 years ago. Bob was at the bottom of that. Bob is odds with Bob Darrell now. Done things together, and he has tremendous influence. Mary is just so, you're delightful in every way. Ralph, Dick, and Polly's gone, but all of you, I love you, and thank you for letting me be a part of it.